Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Throughout the year, the Signature Symphony has presented what it calls a world passport, featuring music from six continents and a variety of cultures well outside the normal classical music centers, coupled with familiar masterworks from the repertoire. For their concert this Saturday, music director Andres Franco presents Mozart's Requiem, along with three works that have a connection to the New World, Tomás de Torreón y Velasco, and Baltasar Martínez y Compañón were Spanish clerics sent to the New World who both wrote music that combines the music of Europe with the rhythms and culture of the New World. Joseph Bellone de Saint George was born in Guadalupe, the son of a colonist planter and his slave, yet rose to the top of late 18th century musical culture in Paris. Amazing backstories for the music that will be presented in a program titled Of Life and Death, to be performed this Saturday at the Van Trees Pace with the Signature Symphony, the Signature Chorale, the TCC Concert Singers, and the Tulsa Opera Studio Artists. Andres Franco is in his second season as music director of the Signature Symphony and also assistant conductor of the Pittsburgh Symphony. And in the spirit of full disclosure, I should mention I am a member of the Signature Symphony. And Andres Franco joins us today here on Studio Tulsa. Andres Franco, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Rich. How are you?
Very well. And throughout the year, Signature Symphony, of which I'm a member, has been doing this very interesting thematic idea, which has involved trying to play music from as many places around the world, and a great deal of it unfamiliar. And certainly this Saturday's concert features a very familiar work, the Mozart Requiem, but also three works by composers that will be virtually unknown to nearly all the audience members.
And that was part of the idea. There's so much great music that was written by composers from many different nationalities that I really wanted to, in every concert, a work that everyone would be familiar with. And if you look at the whole season, the second half usually is the one that has works that everyone recognizes. This weekend, of course, is going to be Mozart's Requiem. But that was the case for every single concert. You know, the Dvorak 9, Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, Copland's Rodeo, and Mahler 1 in our upcoming concert in April. So each one of the concerts would have a piece by a very well-known composer and a very well-known piece. Then the first half, we would be exploring music by composers from around the world.
Now, this one is sort of interesting because there's a chronological sort of element that's also a part of these three composers. Several of these composers were very much active during Mozart's time.
Yeah, in fact, two of them, and that's how the concert started. I decided to Mozart Requiem, and then I started looking for Mozart's contemporaries. There's a chronological aspect and a geographical aspect as well, because the first half is going to be by composers who either were born or worked for most of their lives in the New World. So let's start with Baltasar Martínez Compañón, who wrote a piece of music we're going to be playing. He was a bishop born in Spain. The king of Spain sent him to the New World. Now, back then, there was no Instagram, no Facebook, no cameras, no nothing. So the only way you could know about what was going on in the New World was by actually being there. And, of course, you could also write chronicles, which he did. And most importantly, he also painted watercolors. All those watercolors became part of the Codex Trujillo. It's over 1,400 watercolors. But he went one step further, and he actually wrote music based on what he heard on the streets. So it's a fascinating piece because we're playing three movements out of 20 pieces of music that are found in the Codex Trujillo. So you can look at the watercolors and see what kind of instruments were used at the time. And you can also see the dances and costumes that they had. But you can also go and check charts and, you know, paintings of fruits that were unknown in Europe. And that's what we're going to be performing. Three pieces, the collection of viceroyal music. So three dances that were written by Baltasar Martínez Compañón. And those dances were written between 1782 and 1785. Roughly around the time Mozart was writing The Marriage of Figaro. So he's very much a contemporary of Mozart, except he was already living in the New World. He never went back to Europe. He stayed in the New World, worked in what we call Peru these days for a while. Then he eventually moved to Colombia, and he passed away in Bogota.
Mm-hmm. Now, did he write religious music as well, or did he just bring the religious music of the church to the New World? Or
it's very interesting because most of the pieces that survive in the Codex Trujillo, the 20 pieces, most of them are actually secular music and very much influenced by popular music. There's a lot of religious music from that time and before, and actually the piece that opens the program is a religious piece by a different composer. This one is was born earlier in, it's more like a contemporary of Bach and Handel. He was born in 1644. He died in 1728. Tomás de Torrejón y Velasco. Same story. He was born in Spain. He moved to the New World, and he worked there for a number of years. So we're going to be performing it's a Christmas carol. It's a villancico, or villancico, depending on which, whether you use the Spanish or Latin American pronunciation. And it's also very interesting just for music lovers. If you are into classical music, it's very interesting because, of course, when you moved from Europe to the New World, you were used to the music that was being played while you grew up in Europe. And, of course, back then, things moved at a much slower pace. So by the time these guys were composing, in the case of Tomás de Torrejón y Velasco, it has a little bit of an archaic sound to it, even though the piece is from the 18th century already. It sounds a little bit like late Renaissance music, right, just because that was the style that was being played when he was born and when he went to the conservatory.
I was thinking he was born in the 17th century. And,
right.
And you have to think that his musical influence is formed by the music of the late 17th century.
Exactly. And, of course, there was a lot of trade back then, but I don't know that the musical trends traveled the transatlantic trip as quickly. So, you know, he composed in the music he knew, and maybe he heard what was going on later on in Europe, if he did at all. Much later. And the same thing happens with Baltasar Martínez Compañón. Even though he was born in the 18th century, the music he grew up with was still late Baroque music. So even though the piece is late 18th century, it's not classical in style. It's more Baroque in style. And in fact, if you look at the Codex Trujillo, it is still pretty much as most Baroque music is. There's a soprano line or a melodic line, mm-hmm. and there's a figure bass, and that's more or less all there is. So, you know, it had to be reconstructed. So it's still music of the old style. So it's very interesting just to see that lag in musical development between Europe and the New World, just because, you know, it was hard. That trip was very hard and very dangerous.
Right, but Martínez y Compañón, you're looking at a lot of New World rhythms, at least. Because I think the last time I heard the piece, it's a sort of a Baroque feel, but there's also this rhythmic thing that is a little different, seems to come from the New World.
Yes, absolutely. And that's what makes it so interesting, because when you listen to the piece, if you didn't know anything about it, you will think, this sounds Baroque. There has a little bit of the dance element. But then, yes, there's a lot of syncopation that you normally did not find in European Baroque music. And there's also the instrumentation. And again, you can go and look at the watercolors that the composer himself painted of how the music was played, and you can figure out which instruments were played. So you can see that they used the harp, and we will be using a harp just because that's what was in the paintings he left. You would see a lot of native percussion instruments that, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find any maracas in a Bach cantata or a Handel cantata. Although I have to say, Mozart most likely would have used any and all of those instruments. As you know, he really liked that exotic, quote-unquote, flavor, and he used what they called back then Turkish percussion, like, you know, triangle and mm-hmm. bass drum and cymbals, and he tried to incorporate that in some of his opera music. Beethoven later used the same in his Ninth Symphony. So they were very interested in all of these combinations. So I know that if Mozart had heard the maracas and Guido and all the interesting seed rattles that were used in the New World, I'm sure he would have found a place for them.
But that's what makes this piece sort of interesting, is you have this very Baroque, so the sort of harmonic structure, again, with a Guido and you know, seed gourds and everything else, providing a sort of a rhythmic accompaniment.
Yeah, no, it is fascinating. That's why I always enjoy very much performing the piece, because everyone in the orchestra is already, you can see their eyes like, oh, this is different. I mean, we know this style, but this is a completely different twist to what we know as late Baroque style.
Now, do we know why he wrote this music? Was it court music, if you will?
Yeah, I think basically he went out and heard all of the music that was being performed. Of course, he was a bishop. And the clergy back then had, you know, very serious musical education. Like, you know, they didn't have conservatories, but going to the church and going through the process was pretty much as, in some cases, even more strict than going to a conservatory these days. You have to really learn your counterpoint and write a lot of music. So he was musically trained, and I think he just found it so interesting to hear all of those different rhythms. Now, these are not necessarily transcriptions. There's a compositional element. This is not like he just went out and wrote down what he heard. He obviously wrote the melodies, but you can feel that he was very intrigued by the rhythms that the locals were employing.
I suppose it was maybe a way to sort of meld the two communities at that point.
Yes,
I mean, because you're talking about a forced arrival of Europeans.
And again, going back a little more a century earlier when Tomás de Torrejón y Velasco, that was very much the case. So you will find religious music in the native languages. And it was a very natural, from what I have read, way of doing it. So when the locals had converted to Catholicism, they would start singing the mass parts in their native languages. And I have heard some of them. I have never conducted, but there are a lot of choral orchestral pieces in native languages that would be the same as the Gloria or the Kyrie or any of those mass parts, again, in the local language. So it's very interesting. The Bolivian and Peruvian Baroque music, especially the religious one, is very, very interesting.
Interesting. 200 years before Vatican II, too.
Yes. So it's very... That's true.
Anyway, my guest today is Andrés Franco, the music director of the Signature Symphony. The Signature Symphony will be presenting a program titled Of Life and Death, featuring the Mozart Requiem with Tulsa Opera studio artists as soloist and the Signature Chorale, but also three works in the first half from the New World. And the other work that we haven't talked about, this is a fascinating composer who really wrote in the Old World, but was born in the New World, and that is Bologne de Saint-Georges, Joseph Bologne?
Yeah, Joseph Bologne.
Yeah.
In the first half, I wanted to show that the trade went both ways. It wasn't just Europeans coming to the New World and bringing their culture. It was also people from the New World moving to Europe. And in the case of Joseph Bologne Chevalier de Saint-Georges, and we will go into the name in a little more detail, his is a fascinating story, but I have to make sure that everyone understands that even if there was no story, just his music is amazing, period, full stop. But then when you start researching his life, it's like, oh my God, how is it possible that we do not know more about this person? How is it possible that this music is not being, people are not being taught in college and before about this particular figure? Because again, the music is of the highest quality, but the life story of this gentleman is just unbelievable. So Joseph Bologne, and you will find so many different spellings. That, you know, last year when we were getting ready to print the brochure, we have to come up to an executive decision. Okay, are we going to spell it B-O-L-O-U-G-N-E or B-O-L-O-G-N-E? And some people call him Chevalier de Saint-Georges. Some people call him Saint-Georges. So it's a big mess. And part of it is because his life was so interesting that there was a novel written in the 19th century about him. And people thought it was more of a historical novel talking about real facts. And it turns to be actually mostly fiction. It was based on him. So even the date, if I show you my score, is really funny because on the outside it says 1739 to 1799. And then on the inside, when they talk about his life, is 1745 to 1790. So even the publisher doesn't really know which date it was. We think it was the later one. The 1745 is when he was born. But basically his life story is he was born in Guadeloupe in the French Caribbean, and he was the son of a wealthy planter and one of his African slaves. So he's one of the first, if not the very first, composer of classical music that has an African of African descent. But what is even more amazing is that his father decided that living in the New World with his son wasn't the best of options for him. So he actually decided to move him and his mom to Paris when he was 8. So he was born in the New World. If you look at pictures of him, you can definitely tell that, you know, he has African blood in him. And you can also tell that he had European blood in him. He's very striking looking, very good looking, by the way, and this will play a role later on in his life. But he went to France, and then he became one of the most famous fencers in Europe. So if you look at any fencing treatise from the 18th century and the 19th century, his name will be there as the number one and there were many people who actually challenged him, so he had to do a lot of duels, and he won most of them. I think there was only one where he didn't win when he was later in life, but when he was young, he pretty much beat everyone, and he went to the most prestigious fencing school in Paris, and he defeated everyone in that school. So
it's like Jack Johnson in boxing in the 20th or 20th century.
Yeah, but the most, so that's already amazing on its own right. If you're a fencing fan, go look him up, and then you will be very happy to see and to know his story. He was a guard to the King of France as well. He was very well connected in Paris. The other thing that he pursued was music. And he actually became the concertmaster and conductor of two of Paris's leading orchestras. He was a virtuoso violinist, and he left many violin concertos that are very, very, very hard. And you know, people who play them these days still say, like, "Wow, that's really beyond what violinists would normally do back then." Like, it's really hard stuff to play. And he was the person in charge of commissioning, premiering, and editing Haydn Paris symphonies. With his orchestra. He actually even wanted to be the director of the Paris Opera, and all the divas, there was a small revolt saying, "No, we cannot have somebody with African parentage so to be our boss." So eventually that fell through, but the position was left unfilled, so nobody took the job. But he still was the concertmaster and conductor of two of Paris's most important orchestras. And then during the French Revolution, he actually traveled to London, and he saw the anti-slavery movement. So he went back to France. And, of course, there was a lot of turmoil during this time. So when the French Revolution happened, he was friends with Philippe d'Orléans. And then he also became a colonel in the French Revolutionary Army, which ended up being a big problem because he was still part of the aristocracy. So basically what happened is, with all the political intrigues going on at the time, he did have a legion that he was the colonel of. But eventually, because he was part of the aristocracy before, he was imprisoned and he was almost executed. He wasn't.
Yeah, I was going to say, but
he was in jail, and he had. We still have some of his letters writing, asking for pardon, and you know, just basically saying how much he had done for the revolution. But then eventually he was not executed. But you know, what a life! Like, right. You're born in the French Caribbean, then you move to Paris. Probably, I would imagine back then, one of the very few people who were born to a slave and were in the higher circles of the Parisian court, which was, of course, you know, the court, had been for a number of years in Europe, and to get to the very top and to be able to meet people like Mozart and Haydn and so forth. So it's quite a remarkable story. We just watched, and this is actually part of our World Passport season. We have some events at the Center for Creativity. They're called Passport Preview. And we just had one last week. And on Thursday, we showed a documentary on the life of Joseph Bologne. So he became a Chevalier, and that's why he's known also as Chevalier de Saint George. Sometimes people drop the Chevalier and he becomes Saint George. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he's called Joseph Bologne or Boulogne. So again, it's really hard. It's all of those names refer to the same person.
But despite all that amazing backstory, he wrote interesting music and wrote operas too.
He wrote many operas. He wrote symphonies. He wrote quartets, violin concertos, Sinfonia Concertante. People think that Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante for violin and viola was actually inspired by Chevalier de St. George's Sinfonia Concertantes that he wrote in Paris. And in this movie documentary that we listened to, is really interesting because one of the violinists of the New York Philharmonic is one of St. George's main biographers these days, who has been able to really figure out which story is the real one. And he actually played a passage from Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante. And then he played a passage from St. George's Sinfonia Concertante, which was written before Mozart's. And we know that Mozart was in Paris, and we know that they most likely met, most likely attended a performance, and it's exactly the same. It's verbatim. Except St. George's was in E major, and Mozart's was in E flat major, half step lower. But he plays this like four-bar figure, and it is exactly the same. And it's not something that they would say, you know, any composer from the time would have written that way. No, this is like very high, very virtuosic, with big leaps in the solo part, things that you would not necessarily find in normal, quote-unquote, concertos, but that Mozart used in his Sinfonia Concertante.
Mozart heard that.
Except Bologna had used it in his own piece before.
And, of course, musical cribbing was very common in those days, so it's not like it's plagiarism exactly, but he probably heard the phrase and said, wow, that's a really cool phrase. I have to use that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think back then that was the way music moved forward, and I think still is. You go and listen and you're influenced by different composers, and even if you don't know, you may end up using some turns of phrase here and there that may be similar to other composers.
Well, you know, one of the things about hearing this music is most of this music you're talking about in the first half has not been recorded. But in fact, the piece you're going to play, L'Amant Anonyme, has been recorded just recently, as a matter of fact.
It has been recorded recently, and I highly recommend this recording with Tafel Music. Mm-hmm. The documentary we showed about St. George features Tafel Music playing many of the pieces and then also doing some commentary on the works that they perform. So the name of the album is Le Mozart Noir, the Black Mozart, which is the nickname that he has inherited. And, you know, of course, it's a very catchy nickname, but it is really, I think, a composer of that level that should be performed more often. Speaking of the piece we're going to play, you get to hear two pieces for the price of one if you come to a concert, because this is both a symphony. He published it as two different pieces, but they're actually almost the same. He published it as a symphony, Opus 11, number 2, in D major, and then he also used it as the overture for his opera L'Amant Anonyme. And again, the changes were like two or three bars here and there that were different. But of course, you know, back then, overtures and sinfonias were more or less the same. It was the main structure, and, you know, of course, symphonies were slightly different, but they're still very similar. So you have a fast opening allegro that is in sonata form, as in a symphony. And then you have a slower section in the middle and then a fast section to close. So, again, it works both as a symphony and as an overture. He just took some of the transitional bars so that it becomes like a one movement when performed as an overture.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that new recording from Tafel Music here on Studio Tulsa. That's music by Tafel Music, featuring the music of Joseph Bologne de Saint-Georges, one of the pieces to be played by the Signature Symphony in their program of Life and Death with my guest today, music director Andres Franco. Of course, the second half is the Mozart Requiem. This is a great piece.
Yeah, the Mozart Requiem is just an amazing piece, and another one that has a very interesting backstory and how it came to be finished and all the different legends that were created because of various reasons around it.
From Peter Schaeffer on back.
Yes, exactly. That's the one that made it to mainstream culture, I guess. And so everyone who watched the movie thinks that Salieri poisoned Mozart. And then we know the quote-unquote gray messenger that was the one in charge of commissioning the Requiem. But basically, if you look at it, it was, I mean, at the same time, it was it's a very personal piece. Mozart was aware of, you know, his health problems. He was 35, going on to into 36 soon. He did not make it. And so he was very aware of his own death. And, of course, he grew up in the Catholic Church. So he was very aware of all the religious implications of a Requiem Mass. So this is a very lofty piece on one side, and you can feel Mozart's angst and despair, and you can also feel a lot of hope in some sections. So to me, it's such an amazing emotional journey when you hear the whole piece, because one of the things that Mozart did was start to look into darker spaces of the human soul, which classical music, music from the classical period, for the most part, is very optimistic. You know, most of the time it's in a major key and so forth. Mozart, with his symphony number 25 in G minor, the little G minor symphony, he started looking into these more dark places. And many people at the time thought, I'm not sure that's what music should do, but he definitely pushed that. And then with the Requiem, he would most definitely search those places. Starts in D minor and is very dark, but there are so many movements that are filled with hope. There are so many movements that are filled with just fear. Like the Dies Irae, of course, is terrifying. And these days, you know, now we have listened to so much movie music that sounds similar to it that it doesn't have an impact. But imagine if you were there when it was performed for the first time after Mozart's death, just to hear a music like the Dies Irae with so much power and so much rage, when normally classical music was very, not, I wouldn't say relaxed, but very elegant, very courtly. And then to hear something with so much raw passion in it would have been unbelievable.
You almost have to compare him to other requiems of the time, you know, or even later, you know, when his requiem is having influence. But you think the German requiem, I think of it, that is, you know, yes, there's these dramatic moments, but I also think of the great peace that is a part of that particular piece.
Of course.
You know, I think of the Verdi Requiem is perhaps the only one that has that sort of fear and trepidation and sort of trembling.
And it makes a lot of sense, too, because Mozart was an opera composer. Right. And, you know, probably the best or one of the best to opera composers. And, you know, opera really influenced every aspect of his writing. So when you play symphonies, you really have to think in terms of different characters. And when you play even piano sonatas, you know, every melody is like a different character in a plot. And of course, he applies that to a Requiem. And Verdi was another great operatic composer. So, you know, Verdi wrote a very, very, very operatic piece.
Right.
Mozart's, of course, still a little closer to church music, and you will hear a lot of imitation, a lot of what back then would have been considered something in the old style, closer to the music of Bach and before, when you have the imitation, like in the Kyrie and some of those places. But there are so many other places where it's really opera, and you're listening to arias and ensembles. You know, the four soloists, of course, do a great deal of singing, and Recordare is pretty much like an ensemble from an opera, except the words are from a religious text.
Yeah.
So we have lots of partnerships this weekend. The Tulsa Opera Young Artist will be a soloist, the solo quartet. The signature chorale will be singing the Mozart Requiem, as well as the Tulsa Opera Young Artist. And then for the Tomás de Torrejón y Velasco, for the first piece in the program, we will have the TCC Concert Choir join the signature chorale. Mm. So we have a larger choir to sing this piece that was written by a Spanish composer who moved to the New World.
All right, well, the concert takes place Saturday evening at 7:30. Andres, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, Rich, thank you for having me.
Andres Franco is the music director of the Signature Symphony. He'll be leading the Signature Symphony, the Signature Chorale, the TCC Concert Singers, and the Tulsa Opera Studio Artists in the Mozart Requiem, part of a program titled Of Life and Death, to be performed Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Van Treese Pace. Visit signaturesymphony.org for information. Just also in the spirit of full disclosure, I should mention I am a member of the Signature Symphony. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.